Like,
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to your one and only Mod State Podcast. My friend, how are you?
Now that I can see straight after the Mueller report, I'm good, sir.
Yeah, we let the dust settle on that one for sure. And before we dive into that, because I'm sure if you're an avid listener of the Mod State Podcast, you're dying to get our feedback on the redacted Mueller version. So before we get into that, as always, thank you for tuning into the Mod State Podcast. If you like what you hear here, please head over to modstate.com for more op-ed and opinion pieces. I believe there have been a couple articles that have been dropped. And of recent note, we've had more comments on the Podomatic page.
They love you, Nate. They love listening to you.
So thank you for that engagement. Continue to do that.
Did you read them?
Oh, of course I did. And
they love you. I don't want to say anything negative, but one of us is not loved.
apparently, there's some tallying back and forth in terms of wins and losses. But for those of you out there that are making the tallies, I appreciate that. But I am not keeping count. I am now, apparently, or someone is, and I feel keeping track
about it. I mean, it just kind of underscores what we've talked about anyway.
Yeah, so. Indeed. And end of note, listenership, it kind of ebbs and flows and people have lives and we totally get that. But as of recent, we've had an increase in traffic. So for those of you who have been talking about us or for those of you who are new to the podcast, welcome aboard. I promise you over the next 18 months, this is only going to get crazier.
It is. So we're never going to give you up.
Indeed. So anyway, before we get into the Mueller redaction bar debacle, etc. We will commence with all the fits that make news and why it matters.
You may have noticed that I'm not all there myself.
Dun, dun, dun.
Okay, so here we are. So what there's obviously a number of things out there that in the news, and we'll get to that in subsequent podcast episodes, of course. But you know, I felt it important that we just touch on the blossoming Democratic field that just continues to fill up, and I think now, as you brought up, surpasses the Republican field in 2016, 2017, which,
depending on the official count, it's been vacillating, but it's
vacillating.
Put it to you this way. Well, once the vice president, which we'll get to in a little bit, jumps in there, then it's going to be closer to 20. Mm-hmm. And yeah, it's going to be a lot.
So there's a couple things, obviously, that are concerning about this. The first is a little less obvious, and we'll get to the more obvious. But to me, the less obvious issue here is, if we're so hell-bent on, are so hell-bent on getting Donald Trump out of office, is it advantageous for the field of ideas? Like, is it important to have this economies of scale, right? So an economics economy of scale is bigger is better, but not all the time. So in this case, this huge economy of scale of these Democratic hopefuls, presidential hopefuls, is this quite frankly working in any benefit at all? Is there, I feel like there's not enough. Yeah, I don't. I feel like there's not enough ideas. The only person.
Senator Warren and Senator Sanders.
Okay. Well, here before that, the only truly unique idea in that entire ticket would be probably Andrew Yang with UBI. I mean, that's the number one thing that he is really campaigning on. Sanders is just principled. Elizabeth Warren is, I don't know, she's Elizabeth Warren. There is not a diverse set of ideas.
The reason I point those two out, and I'm not picking on you here, but isn't that something that nowadays we can introduce a candidate who is stuck by largely the same platform for four decades by saying, well, he's just principled? And I'm not picking on you here, the wording there, but that's indicative of where we're at.
Yeah, but
with,
that's
Senator Warren, I point her out because she has come out with, she's awash in white papers right now. She's been that absorbed in policy, and that's not a criticism. Well, it's a constructive criticism, I guess you could say, but not all critiques are bad. She's elaborated thoroughly. You don't have to wonder what her thoughts are on what she's going to do.
Yeah, but that was Hillary Clinton's downfall. Hillary Clinton was just, if not more, policy-driven.
Hillary's big thing, though, was we're not really going to vote for this guy, are we? That's why she didn't show up in Wisconsin.
That's true, but also she was not entertainment the way Donald Trump was. Yeah, obviously, you're absolutely right. There were other factors, obviously, why Hillary lost. The problem is, unlike Bernie Sanders, who's spent four decades in service, his history is not quite as marred and full of, I don't want to say controversy is the right, but she certainly has been part of some controversial things over time that make people very much against her or for her. But I guess you could say the same thing about Bernie too.
The answer is to attempt to not out Donald the Donald, because I don't know that's possible. I don't know that you want to try that anyway.
If you out Donald the Donald, it becomes an Idiocracy movie.
Right. So it becomes an episode of Aqua Teen Hunger Force, at any moment. So the answer would be, though, to fight fire with fire then and nominate a, say, Vice President Biden?
Yeah. The movie 8 Mile. The one of the last scenes when Eminem is having his rap battle, and he essentially raps everything about himself right up front, and then the incumbent really had nothing to fire back on him. This would be a case with Biden, even with Anita Hill, even with some of his other issues he's had.
Legislation.
But even with Anita Hill, something that someone could actually go after in terms of sexism, etc.
That would be riot.
There's nothing that Biden has done that has been.
He'll do it though.
He would, and he would make himself look good. That would be absolutely hilarious about it. So,
the thing that the game changer here is Donald Trump in and of himself, because love him, hate him, I don't know how you could be indifferent, but if you are. I try to be as much as I can be a neutral observer here. It's very difficult to be. But the man has no scruples, okay? He will go after him for that. He will go after him for the tough on crime legislation. I would, anyway. I would encourage him to do that. Vice President Biden's support for President Clinton's tough on crime legislation because of the First Step legislation signed by President Trump. That's actually a real strength of his.
Yeah, it is.
Against Biden.
So what you're saying almost is that because Donald is the way he is, the president is the way he is, that he can make Joe Biden look bad for Anita Hill, make him look even worse for his stance on criminal justice, all while just completely overlooking everything he said about women videos. Because Biden has never had to be in an arena where he's ever had to sort of defend that and then use a Donald Trump type tactic back on someone. That's why Marco Rubio looks so stupid.
Look at all the controversies that would have killed any other candidacy. How many times did you starting with Megyn Kelly to Carly Farina to accusing Ted Cruz's father of being involved in the Kennedy assassination?
It
would have killed another campaign.
Exactly. So Donald Trump could literally walk onto a debate stage with Joe Biden, call him out for Anita Hill, one-up him on criminal justice, all while he's got said all those things about all those women, plus the TMZ or that Access Hollywood video that came out about just grabbing women. And it would just, we all know that happened. So
That's the thing. This is some, and he's, it, the greatest part would be to see how Biden responds to the one-liners, because you know he would. But, I mean, seriously, we could sell tickets. But seriously, this is someone who, in a way, has never known defeat, because he doesn't accept what you and I view as the conventional terms of winning and losing. Mm-hmm. It's somehow or another, he's going to obfuscate things and argue. I mean, it's brilliant in a classroom type way, in an academic way, in the sense that he's able to frame even the worst losses as somehow, hey, that's just who he is. He's just, I mean, people go, oh, that's just politics. And I'm going, no, it isn't. But it is, because mm-hmm. of who we're talking about. I know it sounds strange, but.
Yeah. Well, anyway, that,
on that.
Yeah, I think that is a good place to stop for all the fits. Because I think the Mueller investigation and the two-part, sort of two chapters of the report actually could be a bit of a weakness for the president. So without further ado, I give you the next segment on this podcast episode.
Well, as far as breaking down the two volumes, the mm-hmm. first one's pretty straightforward as far as...
Well, let me stop you there real quick. I hate to stop you, but let's... So the first place that we were at the last time we talked about this, the Barr memo came out. And again, folks, if you've been following us and you have been listening to us, so far in terms of predictions, we haven't been too far off. I'm not saying we have a magic ball or wand or a crystal ball. However, I think... I felt somewhat validated, and I think you did too, when the Barr memo came out and basically said, yeah, nothing to see here, really. And then we said, then the rest of the world said, okay, well, give us the full report, okay? Well, then we got a redacted version, and that's what we're talking about now. Now, in full disclosure, I didn't read a piece of it, and that's why I have an amazing podcast partner and an amazing... a business partner who did read the entire thing. And I think we came also to the same conclusion. I obviously listened to as many media outlets and journalists I could, and I just didn't have the time to read the whole 400 pages. However, it sort of seems like, and you were just about to talk about that, and this is where I'll let you pick up about the two chapters.
I'm gonna be pretty quick here as far as a synopsis of this. Volume one is, and that's how Robert Mueller quantified it, was volume one, volume two. Volume one was about whether or not Russia actually interfered in the 2016 election. And if anybody remembers, that was originally his mandate. Volume two is about whether or not the president attempted to interfere with the investigation. And the entire reason that Volume 2 came about as, and this, not me saying this, it's a paraphrase of Robert Mueller, is largely due to the firing of the then FBI director, James Comey. Mm-hmm. Was that an attempt to derail the investigation? That's where things get off the rails, if you will, as far as it becomes much more polarizing, Volume 2. Volume 1 is pretty straightforward. Based on the information we have, and there's been a lot of punditry out there, of course, I've said it to you before, I'll say it again. It's hard to argue that the mainstream media is not an extended arm in the Democratic Party in a lot of ways. Volume one, it was, well, maybe they didn't get the full story. Okay, well, they had enough damn time. Hmm. If they didn't get the full story for volume one about whether Russia interfered or not, I'm sorry.
Well,
the special counsel was that there was not evidence to show that Donald Trump himself was involved in any sort of coordination with Russia in the campaign.
And so that's the important part right there, is that the president of the United States did not. However, we do know that Russia actively tried to interfere in the elections by swaying public sentiment, not necessarily hacking into election systems.
Right. But no swaying, vote tallies, not once did we see any evidence. And I hit that point pretty hard in the column I posted on ModState. Not one shred of evidence showed voter tallies being changed. Mm-hmm. And that's a drum that I beat for quite a while heading into this. And sure enough, we were validated there. Where things really get murky is, and it's a very quiet chapter that the mainstream media has not talked about. I haven't heard anything coming from Fox's camp about this, but there's a little portion in there about how the Obama administration had known since at least 2014 that Russia had infiltrated our election system. And what's curious about that is, okay, if they found out about it in 2014, you know that it had been going on for longer. Why do nothing? And of course, the speculation is, well, think about the Iran deal that was going on at the time. The Obama administration probably didn't want to poison the well, but Susan Rice specifically instructed the National Security Advisor at the time, specifically instructed, and this is all in Mueller's report, them to, quote, cut it out or knock that off. And I'm assuming that that's saying, hey, look, we're trying to do something here bigger than that. We need Russia at the table. Either way, waited until after the election to slap sanctions that even a former Obama administration official said was basically slapping the wrist, sanctioning Russia like this. So this isn't about, this is not me playing the role of Sean Hannity and trying to say, well, what about it? No, no. Mm-hmm. I'm just pointing that out as it's murkier than folks think it is. Volume one is not so simple as the Trump Tower meeting and that's it. Mm-hmm. Volume two, again, gets a lot murkier because we're talking about individuals. Don McGahn, who you're going to hear from in congressional testimony, the former White House counsel, his words now being disputed by another lawyer, Mr. Dowd, who worked for the president. But long story short, Mueller makes this point. This is the crux, where he says, while there was not enough to outright charge the president with obstruction of justice, there certainly is enough here. There's enough questions raised that this report does not constitute an exoneration. Mm-hmm. And with that, he then follows, I believe it's 10 points, where he says, look, I don't, and this was good of Mueller to do this. He said, look, I'm not saying that these points constitute obstruction. That's up to Congress to decide. For instance, the dismissal of James Comey in and of itself.
He was very clear about that.
Right. And that, again, that depends upon your perspective. Okay, if that constitutes obstruction, because Donald Trump is cited in the evidence as saying he knew the investigation would continue one way or the other. So I'm not sure that that specific point, I mean, you could argue it as obstruction, but...
Well, I think clear that it was, he really was leaving it up to Congress. He didn't want the power.
Right.
Even if he could charge the president, it would be up to Congress to make that decision.
Right. And one of the reasons, folks, you're probably wondering, okay, but why, if he had the ability to do that and prevent a congressional fiasco, this was an important point of fairness that Robert Mueller made. He said, look, if I indict a sitting president, again, this is me paraphrasing, folks, so you don't have to read 448 pages to get this. But he said, look, if I indict a sitting president, he's not going to have the opportunity to rebut this in open court like he would if a federal grand jury here's this case, okay? Which is very true. It would go into congressional hearings where the American people, they're going to hear indictment, they think a conviction. That's mm-hmm. not the same thing. It means they can be arraigned for charges, okay? With the other side of that coin, as I pointed out in, or I am pointing out in my response to volume two, my summary of volume two is, okay, that federal grand jury pool would get picked from the DC area, which I'm providing a screenshot with this article of how 92% of that electorate voted for Hillary Clinton. Where are you going to find 12 members of a jury? Where are you going to find a jury of Donald Trump's peers in that area where he's going to get a fair trial, where the mainstream media is not so thoroughly poisoned the well here? But back to the report, I think it was fair of Mueller to relatively end on that note saying, look, it wouldn't have really been fair, in a sense, to do that, because all people are going to hear is an indictment. Congress has the tools to deal with this. The president wouldn't be able to respond in an effective manner. So there's a lot more gray in volume two, in my view, than in volume one.
So do you think volume two obviously could present more of an issue for Donald Trump in the future in terms of election? Because It did not paint him. So obviously he's tweeted quite a bit after this, and he's been pushing the narrative that this is full exoneration. He did nothing wrong. He said that from the beginning. But if you actually do look at volume two, it paints the president as less angelic than he would like to seem. out of this two-part series. I think it was pointed out, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, but it made clear that he did actively, whether he knew the investigation was going to go on no matter what, he did ask people around him to lie. He did ask people to derail the investigation, and against the and actually for the better judgment of those around him, they actively resisted those orders. Whether they were orders or just more of a, gosh, I really need you. I'd really, really like it if you do this. Not really a kind of the code that Donald Trump speaks in. Maybe not a direct order, but something along the lines of it'd be really nice if this was taken care of. Or it'd be really nice if you said this. It just doesn't paint the president as the upstanding citizen. But again, I guess my question is, are we surprised?
Here's, again, I'm not saying it makes the president out to be a bad guy, okay? I don't know how much different it is than the way the game has been played for quite a while. Remember, exactly. Even President Clinton was accused of obstruction of justice over something people love to point out how minor of an infraction oral sex in the Oval Office is. Well, that's not why he was charged with obstruction. He perjured himself before Congress. Well, so fast forward to today, I get it, it's two different situations. But remember, the president saying, ranting things on Twitter, that's his First Amendment rights. And concerning lies to the media, that's not illegal. Okay, where we get into murky territory is with the pressuring of Jeff Sessions. But I point this out in the article that, look, at the same time, this was a wholesale rejection of his mandate in a sense that how did he not recall having these meetings with Russians? I mean, I get President Trump's frustration with Jeff Sessions in that sense. I really do. It's like, well, what do you mean you didn't recall? And so therefore you have to recuse yourself from this. I mean, Mueller attempts to connect a lot of dots there that there are some leaps of faith made, I'm going to say. I mean, in all fairness, do I think it presents a potential issue for the president in terms of whether his presidency will survive, unless there's something else coming out, maybe some of the redacted portions of it. I think it was 37 pages, 47 pages total that are redacted. You know, it's not straight pages, most of it. It's just portions that are blacked out. But unless something from that emerges, one of the ongoing federal grand jury processes, I don't see it being an existential crisis. Mm-hmm. For one thing, it's not going to get through the Senate unless, I mean, it would have to be damn serious.
Yeah.
Another is we don't even know if House Speaker Nancy Pelosi is going to take that political risk. Okay. In terms of reelection, it would have to be pretty damning to move the needle that significantly. Mm-hmm. As far as what's in there right now, I don't see it changing. I'm not going to say any. I'm not going to see it changing many minds enough to make a difference.
As I like to say, I think there's a very high statistical probability that nothing comes of this. And really, that's an interesting point you bring up. And it's obviously been brought up by a lot of people. But really, the options now, with literally 18 months or less with this presidency, this first go around, that you either leave it, you either go forward with impeachment proceedings and it doesn't work, and now you look like the political fool, and a big time waster, and then you're voted out, or you let the election take care of it. You let the populace take care of it. Now, the problem with that is, and as why I felt it was important, excuse me, to talk about the current Democratic field is you'd think it would be as easy as just saying, well, look, just leave it up to the population to take care of this. We'll just vote this guy out. That's be the impeachment. That is not so simple anymore. The fact is, I think,
want to be Nancy Pelosi.
No, I think at this point there's less certainty. Or if you truly believe he's going to be voted out, there's got to be a place in your soul somewhere that says I'm not as certain today than 1 year ago that this president is going to be voted out of office in 2020. I think that's where it sort of leads us right now. I think that an unredacted version that Nadler seeks so badly that he would like to see is really going to show nothing. I believe that Trump's problems really now rest in the Southern District of New York. And not really Trump's problems, but the...
Well, again, if there was a black and white smoking gun, this is the end of his presidency moment, we wouldn't be here. Okay, we wouldn't be having this conversation, this specific conversation.
I agree with you.
That would have already come out and been, okay, dude, you can either resign or we're going to present this. I mean, it's so graphic. Mitch McConnell doesn't have a choice.
I was going to say, it's that case where the Senate, it just for their own reelection and just being honest players in society, would have to move ahead with impeachment proceedings.
I mean, it would have to be something where, like, Richard Nixon had like 10, maybe 12 votes in the Senate guaranteed. Mm-hmm. Okay. You know, who knows what would have happened in a Senate trial? I get it. His family wanted him to fight. But based on what we know, okay, if it was that severe, again, I have to believe if something that's been redacted was that bad, that there would have been no hesitation on Mueller's part.
Yeah. Now, let's just switch gears. We've talked about the report. We've talked about Mueller. We've talked about the implications for 2020. I do feel like we need to address and just talk about briefly the usage of, and it's well within the power of the president to appoint his AG, and then of course it's up to the Senate to confirm. However, I think, again, we've had a couple cases, especially with the government shutdown, and especially in the case of Barr as the AG, where politics become, like, if you don't follow politics and you just happen to follow things on the periphery, this is a really good example of politics. And I think, now look, Mueller's report was sort of, you almost might say, inconclusive. It wasn't that. Like you said, he said it doesn't exonerate the president. However, we really don't have enough information to go ahead and indict.
He engages heavily in the fine art of hint dropping.
Yeah. Now, there is a difference in the way Bill Clinton obstructed justice. He committed perjury.
There is. I wasn't drawing a parallel.
Now, but there are parallels, right? Because you always will draw parallels to presidents.
Look, everybody
who
loves to bring up Nixon. Watergate. Well, no,
but there are parallels between every president that's been under investigation. Bush was never under investigation. Obama was never under investigation. Trump has been. Clinton was, and so was Nixon. So there are parallels you can draw. Now, the parallels that I'm drawing are just the way it was handled, right? The redactions, the AG going to bat for the president. I think that
The actions aren't solely the AG's doing. Remember,
this is true.
First of all, federal grand jury records, folks, are secured forever.
That's
the law of the land.
You're right. So, but regardless of whether
he's talking about his press conference,
it is really sort of everything. Everything about it was
kind of prefaced it in a way to kind of sugarcoat this a little bit for the American public. The 4-page summary, because he
was it sugarcoating it for the. Was it so? Here's where we might differ. Was he sugarcoating it for the American people, or was he doing it for the president? That's the thing.
I think he was sugarcoating it for the benefit
of
the president.
Yes, which just has this weird smell of non-democratic or undemocratic dealing. I mean, because again, we're supposed to have separation of powers, right? The president can appoint these people, but the AG doesn't work for the president. And it was weird watching the AG seem like he was working for the president actively. I mean, he does work for the president, but it sounded a lot more like something Rudy Giuliani could have been doing. You know what I mean? I mean, that was just sort of my gut feeling to it. And I'm not...
Part of me goes, okay, I come back to this whole thing got out of control and so far beyond its mandate to begin with. Maybe this is the way, you know, if a piece of paper has been folded in half one way, the only way to straighten the piece of paper out again is to fold it back the other way. Maybe that's what Barr was doing, saying, look, this fiasco got out of control and beyond its mandate to begin with. I'm going to soften the blow here a little bit. I don't know. I can't really speak to that. I'm not going to say he was untruthful at any point.
No, he wasn't. He
provided a complete picture.
Yeah, he certainly wasn't untruthful. And he certainly, once the redacted version came out, it wasn't as if it was his memo was wrong. But when you read
it's
the
not
sec-
like he took everything damaging in there out.
But if you read the second, if you read the second volume, you sort of get a different picture than what Barr was presenting. And I think that's what in my research.
Well, number of levels.
Yeah, exactly. And look, that's politics, right? That's, I think Barr did exactly what he was friggin' supposed to do. And that's why he was there. I mean, that's to me, that's what that smelled like. But that's really more of a side note than anything, and maybe not the most important thing to end with, but really the sort of implication from this moving forward to 2020 to me is more interesting. I'm glad that our president did not commit treason. I'm glad that there's ample evidence that shows that there was no treason. And now the obstruction case is a little murkier, but I think I have an easier time with the obstruction case. Like, if I had to pick a crime, the lesser of the crime to me would be the obstruction piece, as opposed to the treason piece. And it still bothers bothers me that there's a number of people out there that wish the president had committed treason.
Well, because Mueller brings up an important point also in volume two when he talks about motive. Because several aspects. I mean, he on each of the, I believe, again, it's 10 points of possible obstruction, and he does call it that, or potential, I forget the exact word. But at each point, there's also a motive. That's a part of any crime like this, is finding out, okay, there has to be a motive. And he makes the point that it would specifically depend upon whether the president was making said moves for his own personal political survival. Well, okay, that's very broad by design. And again, we could see that maybe the president, Barr and company really felt like, okay, this is much ado about nothing with Russia. Damn right, I'm going to derail an investigation that shouldn't be happening in the first place. Am I saying that is correct? That's the right thing to do? No. Okay. But there is a difference in unethical and illegal.
That's very true. No, you're absolutely right.
Now, it's not the prettiest defense. It comes back to Mueller saying, look, this doesn't condemn him. It doesn't make him entirely innocent either.
Exactly. But innocent enough that we're not going to indict him.
It's like being acquitted versus being not guilty.
True. Yes. So we're rolling up on 30 minutes, and I feel like we packed a lot into that one. I did want to put it out there to listeners in subsequent podcast episodes that will be getting back into some more macro topics and looking beyond the domestic issues here in the United States.
We had to hit this one.
But we had to. We let the dust settle on it for a little while. We had some schedule conflicts and some illness stuff. But again, I'm happy to let the dust settle on this kind of stuff and then talk about it after we've really had a chance to dig deep.
People got to wonder for a few days whether or not I really am as big of a jerk as I probably came off of my column, especially towards millennials. I don't apologize for it. I had fun.
You got to think about millennials. We'll have to have a podcast episode debating the
dude.
I'm just saying we could the pros and cons of the millennial generation.
Why did I have to be born in this generation?
Yeah, man, you were born in the wrong generation. Not necessarily it's the wrong generation, but you were specifically born in the wrong generation.
Yeah, I mean, maybe it's because this is what we were destined to do. I don't know, but I mean, I'm telling you, I hear the crying at times, and I'm going, maybe it's weird because you were, I mean, not physically there, but you were there emotionally, personally, after my injury, coming all the things the past 4 years. Okay, in some ways, all of that has made me so much softer, more understanding towards humanity. But on the other hand, specifically with our generation, when it comes to taking the moral high ground on things, I'm sorry, I call a spade a spade. And it's, man, well, maybe it's so, such a time as this is why we're here.
So we can find, of course, that article you keep referencing over at modstate.com. That is modstate.com for all of your op-ed and opinion pieces. So as always, my friend, it's an honor and pleasure to do this with you, and I'm glad to be back on the airwaves with you.
Absolutely.
So until next time.
Au revoir.